Hey, done. Hello, everyone. Hello, hello. We are live, and today we are speaking with Don Schenk from Red Hat.
Hi,
Don.
Hello, Bertrand. How are you doing today?
We are doing great. We are very happy to do the show today with you. So tell me a little bit about what you're doing for Red Hat.
Well, I was hired on Red Hat just over a year ago as it's called Director of Developer Experience, or some people call it Developer Evangelist. I prefer Developer Advocate. But I'm the person at Red Hat who's responsible for advocating and evangelizing .NET on Linux. So I'm the only person, I mean, we have engineers, obviously, that work on it, but I'm the person out, you know, speaking at conferences. I wrote a book about it,
wow.
In fact. Yeah, and it's
I
a free download
that.
From our website. Yeah, one today. So
we're doing
that's
great.
What I do. I have material and do presentations and things like this
so
today and conferences, blah, 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 blah.
What you're doing
just to promote Linux and .NET together.
Cool. This is Rich. So were you able to write that book on company time, kind of as part of trying to show people that this scenario exists and is good, or did you somehow just do that on your spare time?
It was a combination of company time and my own time. If anybody that's ever written a book knows, it turns out to be a lot more work than you think it is. It was part of my job, so I at least used company time. But there were nights and weekends where I worked on it. Anybody ever wants to write a book, let me tell you what the hardest part of writing a book is. There's two parts. The research, like for a book for development, the hardest thing is, like, you're going to write, here's how you do this, but you have to actually do it to make sure that it works. And then you have to do it, like, with a clean machine, like, from their standpoint.
Yeah.
So you can never assume anything. So you're constantly, like, wiping out your machine and starting over and wiping out your machine and starting over. So it's just, it takes a very long time.
It makes you thankful for VMs.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Did you use VMs or containers or anything like that to make your life easier?
Yes. We have what's called the Red Hat Development Suite, which has a RHEL VM, RHEL Red Hat Enterprise Linux VM. And so that you can just – it uses VirtualBox and Vagrant. So I would just wipe out the VirtualBox and then start over. And I do that all the time. But you still have to install .NET on it, which is easy. But still takes time.
Yeah, we'll definitely put the URL for the book in the description of the video so that people can check it out and download and
and read. That'd be great.
Fantastic. Excellent. So for those of our viewers who are not super familiar with Red Hat, can you explain a little bit about what Red Hat is doing, what RHEL is, what Fedora is, etc.?
Sure. Well, by now most people have heard of Linux, so it's an operating
system.
Well, there may be some. I mean, but it's an operating system. That's the bottom, the floor level, so to speak. But Red Hat is, we're the largest Linux distribution. We are the first $2 billion open source company. When I was training there, they said we make our money by selling free software. So what we do at Red Hat is we have a subscription service. Not unlike if you get support from Microsoft. That is, well, like, here's the operating system, but for support in that, you subscribe with us. And then we have packages that you can install that are, I like to say, they're vetted, so that we, you know, they've been run through all kinds of testing and so on and so forth, like including .NET, right? We build .NET for RHEL, which is Red Hat Enterprise Linux, and then we make sure it's good before we put it out there. So it's a server software. There is a workstation and a desktop, but the largest part of it, people run it on their servers. So, like, they're running web services or websites. Fedora is, and our software is open source, everything we do. In fact, it was really cool recently. Our CEO was in I think it was Bloomberg TV interview, and they said, don't you worry about intellectual property? And he said, we don't have any. Our stuff's open source. Which I thought, that's a great way to get around that. Fedora is a desktop version of Linux. Like, if you are a hobbyist or you want to, you know, you want to run RHEL on your Mac or whatever, your machine, you can download, say, Fedora and install it. Now, Fedora is what we call upstream. For those that aren't familiar with open source, you have upstream is it's think of as RHEL as a lake, and upstream is up to where everything starts. So as it comes down the stream from Fedora, that's upstream. We actually take things out of Fedora and say, well, that, you know, enterprise customers don't need that in a server software. So we take things out, and we also, again, vet it, test it, make sure everything's good. And if there is a problem, we go upstream to fix it, right? You can't go downstream to fix the source, so to speak. So we do it that way. So that's the relationship. Fedora is, you know, great if you want to run a desktop Linux, and it feeds into Red Hat. RHEL doesn't have as many things in it. It has just enterprise bits.
So do you provide different levels of support for both of them? Do you have customers who are on Fedora and customers who are on RHEL?
Well, we have customers on RHEL, obviously, and there's, you know, a lot of support for that. I mean, that's where we make our money, basically, or part of it. Fedora, no, that's open source software. It's like any other. If you went with Ubuntu or Debian or any other, if you download a Linux and put it on your laptop, you're on your own. Now, when I say that, you're not, because there's a whole open source community. And that's the coolest thing about open source, I think, is the community part of it. We have local user groups. You have the Fedora repo on GitHub. There's a website. I mean, any open source software is going to have a community around it, and you get support that way. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you're just thrown out there on your own. I mean, you can always find answers to questions. And so, because it's open source, you can always, you know, put in a pull request. That is, you can submit a fix or a patch or an improvement or documentation or whatever.
Right. You did mention Ubuntu. So Debian is definitely in that full-on open source. I'll move the camera to me. Is in that full-on open source space. I was under the impression, though, with Ubuntu, that it was maybe more similar to Red Hat from the perspective that there's Canonical, which is another, you know, corporate entity that is kind of tied to Ubuntu. Could you maybe, for our listeners or viewers, kind of talk about similarities and differences there?
Well, I'd say the biggest difference there is we have the RHEL Enterprise, the Red Hat Enterprise Linux. I'm just going to say RHEL from now on. And that's something you purchase the support for. I mean, that's our business model. I'm not, to be honest with you, I don't really know what Canonical's business model is. I know they have some products. But in both cases, the situation you have is kind of, there's a phrase, benevolent dictator for life. And that means it's like Microsoft with .NET. The companies, even though the software is open source, the companies are responsible for the release up for what goes into it. So you can't just go to Ubuntu on GitHub and put in some code to make it break and say, oh, I like Red Hat, so I'm going to break Ubuntu. And you couldn't do vice versa, just like I couldn't go into the .NET stuff and put some ridiculous code in that wouldn't make any sense, right? It gets reviewed, and somebody was going to say, well, no, we can't do this. And the final say for .NET is Microsoft, the final say for RHEL is Red Hat, and the final say for Ubuntu is Canonical. So that's the relationship between the companies and the software. Our relationship with Canonical is, quite frankly, we're competitors. We're larger, but like, you know, Microsoft's larger than other companies, but you keep an eye on them, right? So
makes sense. Sure. We're familiar with that.
Okay, so the reason why we're talking about Red Hat today is that there is a strong partnership between the .NET team and Red Hat, and we wanted to show a little bit about what you're doing with .NET. So why was Red Hat interested in .NET in the first place?
Well, okay, so Red Hat's always been about open source. I mean, we even internally, when we use software, we have a bias toward open source. We really support it. We have an open structure at work with decision making, which is, if you ever were inside Red Hat, you would call it arguing, but we have very open, it's a very open environment. So when .NET became open source, when .NET Framework became open source, right away our ears perked up. You're like, hey, this is great because we embrace the open source community and this is a good thing. And I mean, let's face it, Red Hat's biggest thing in development is Java. That's where we have JBoss and things like that, those products. But .NET is, I don't know if it's as big or bigger than Java or a little bit. I mean, they're like this, right? They're the two biggest players in enterprise software. So it makes perfectly good sense to say, well, if .NET's open source and a lot of people use .NET, why not embrace it as Red Hat? And that's what we did. So we formed a legally binding agreement with Microsoft. There were lawyers involved, so you know how that goes. But we are, I think, I don't remember what the term is, like the Linux distribution of record or something like that. I don't know the legal phrase, but we're like the official one when it comes to support. And for example, we have support engineers from Red Hat literally sitting side by side with Microsoft support engineers. So when you call for support, you can get help from either. So that's why we embrace it, and that's how we embrace it.
Makes sense.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about Java. What other development platforms are available on Red Hat and have a strong presence?
Yeah, well, Java is the biggest by far. That's the heavyweight with Red Hat. I mean, it's hard to separate Java and Red Hat. It really is. And then, you know, any other language that runs in Linux is obviously supported by Red Hat, but not, we don't have, let's say, a product for Node.js, but obviously it works on it. We have this thing called OpenShift, which is a platform as a service, because that supports, you know, any language. So that kind of is a supporting of a language, so to speak. But not .NET is the only specific like framework/language that we've gone after, which I think is, when I came to Red Hat, I've always been a .NET-er, so to speak. My previous job, I was a developer advocate in the .NET world in a Linux company. So I think it's awesome because I get to be like I'm on the oddball, which works perfectly for me. And I just think it's great that the .NET has staked out enough ground that, you know, Red Hat can be like, okay, we're going to focus on .NET. Like, there's no developer advocate for Python running around for Red Hat, but there is for .NET, so that's awesome.
Right, so you're kind of saying that if you put Java to the side for the moment, because as you said, Red Hat has a very strong relationship and history there. If you put that aside for a moment, then .NET is fairly unique.
Oh, absolutely. It's unique in Red Hat, and because it's kind of new, it's kind of unique in the Linux world. I mean, last place I worked, I was, I wouldn't say mocked, in a bad way, but it was a lot of fun making fun of me about the .NET guy and the C# and things like that. I mean, it was all in fun, but at the same time, nobody else there was going to write C# code, and I just said, well, you know, you guys can, it's good that you hobbyists have your language. That was my comeback. But you know, it's great. It's fantastic. And yes, it is unique, which is great for me because
yes.
I'm unique, like everybody else.
Yeah, you talked about why this was interesting, this direction was interesting for Red Hat. I think we can comment a bit on why this was interesting for Microsoft, which is, I guess it's two-part. One is that I think there's this realization, it's a long-term realization, it's not recent, that many companies run heterogeneous environments with both Windows and Linux. And so we want to make sure that our development platforms can work for those customers kind of in whole, so across that entire environment. And then the other thing is Linux is becoming ever more popular in Azure, so it makes sense that, you know, both Bertrand and I work on .NET and, you know, Visual Studio, like the working developer division. And so these companies come to the Azure team and say, you know, we're going to do... We love Azure, you know, it's got a good networking stack or whatever the reason is that they decide to use Azure, and they say, what development platform do you recommend? And normally, when you come with Windows, that would be obvious to say .NET. And in the past, before we had .NET Core for Linux, it kind of would have been difficult for them to really recommend something mm-hmm. for those Linux customers, and now it's obvious. It's like, oh yeah, you're doing Windows, do .NET Core. If you're doing Linux, do .NET Core, and it'll be awesome. And we've got a great solution for you.
I visited a customer Monday, and they're starting to do some .NET Core development, and they were remarking how great it was to have the choice of where to run it. Like, we can run it on our RHEL machines or Microsoft servers, because they're exactly what you said. They have RHEL and Microsoft both in their systems, in their architecture, and they can just choose where to run it, which is, that's fantastic. That's just absolutely great.
Right. You can even take the exact same binaries. I've done this demo at conferences mm-hmm. where I don't have it here today, but I have a Mac laptop. And so I'll be on the Mac side. I'll build an application, and then I will go into Parallels on the Windows side. Mm-hmm. And then in Parallels, the Mac file system gets exposed to Windows. And so then I'll you know, CD into that with from the command prompt. And then I'll run that exact same application that I built, meaning mm-hmm. I won't build it again.
Right.
Take those binaries that I built, and I'll run them on Windows, and they work. Which is actually pretty cool.
Yeah, the portable application is cool. That's very cool. And .NET, I don't know. This another thing I find that developers don't know and are finding interesting is this: the standalone application, where you can build. I can build on Linux and target Windows, let's say, and that's how I do my builds for Linux containers. I don't install .NET in my Linux container. I build a standalone application and put it in a Linux container, and it runs. And people are like, whoa, you didn't install .NET. I'm like, nope, you don't have to. That's really great.
Yep.
So we've talked about what's similar, what's the same between platforms. How would you describe the differences between a Red Hat development environment for .NET and a Windows environment for .NET?
Well, the slashes go different directions. That's that. So that's the first thing I noticed. Actually, that's not 100% true. If you're a .NET developer using Windows and you're not using PowerShell, let me right now just say you should be using PowerShell. I'm a fanatical lover of PowerShell. I wrote an entire PowerShell client for OpenStack.
I was actually going to ask you that question, which Windows shell you use.
PowerShell. There is no other. I mean, in my opinion, and that of James Snover, who invented it. So when I think James Snover invented PowerShell,
Jeffrey Snover. Just
Jeffrey. That's it. That's it. I knew it. I knew it didn't sound right.
You got the
when
J.
Jeffrey Snover invented it. He took a lot of the hints from Bash, which is the shell for Linux. So there's a lot of similarities if you use the two. Some of the differences. Like as a developer, the first thing you notice is Linux is case sensitive, like for folder directory. So here's another one. In Windows, we call them folders. In Linux world, everybody says directories, and they used to laugh at me and say, a folder is a graphical vision of a directory. I'm like, okay, whatever. And other than that, the biggest differences are mostly, believe it or not, cultural, in that, and I go to .NET developer meetings all the time, and then I have to be around Linux people. I shouldn't say have to be around. I get to be around Linux people, and it's just a different culture. Linux, and I don't know why. I guess it's because the way it came along. Linux people that I've worked with all like to work at the command line. They just mm-hmm. they really like the command line. And you know, I came from Visual Studio, which I argue is the greatest development platform ever. I mean, IDE. I just think it's fantastic. I really do. And that's not. I'm not saying this because I want Microsoft. I would say this if I was anywhere. I just love Visual Studio. So when you come from Windows, you're like, well, I just want to point and click here and have it work. And Linux people are like, no, man, there's a command line tool for that. So it's like, okay. So the biggest thing is just cultural. Because this is the coolest thing, and I mentioned this in my demo. When I do my talk about introduction to .NET on Linux. About halfway through it, I point out that, you know, I could be doing all this at the command line PowerShell. Like, once you get over that, oh, it's Linux, it's like, well, what's the big deal? And I'm like, that's the whole beauty. That's the idea of it. Once you get over the operating system, small nuances, And from a developer standpoint, they are small. It's just .NET. That's what's so great about it. I mean, once you get over the slashes and the and some commands, you know.
Even on Windows, you have that choice, and if you're a command line person on Windows, you can work with .NET. So.
Yeah, that's what's so cool. You can like go back and forth, and it's the same.
I think though, with what you described on the cultural side, I think it's actually some of it, and this is kind of what Bertrand was hinting at. Some of it is less Windows versus Linux. So, for example, I never use this term folders. I've always used the term directories.
And in our documentation, we try to say directory.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's because, while I'm definitely a Windows user, I've been using the Microsoft stack since I was 10 years old. I started with DOS. DOS 2, there was no GUI to use, and so I've always kept that that kind of command line first preference. And so I think when you do talk to Windows users that use terms like folder, it's very clear that they're like a Windows shell.
Yeah,
type thing. So I think that's actually the biggest difference.
I didn't have a choice when I started programming.
Yes, yeah, because
there was no.
He started in the 1800s, so
exactly.
you're more accurate. But it's interesting because when you're in the File Explorer and you right mouse click, there's an option for new folder. So yeah, that is the difference. I guess I'm running into a lot of developers.
We should probably not spend 10 minutes on folders versus directory. I believe you have a demo.
See, you want me to do a demo?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go in and create this new folder, or is it a directory, guys? So let me figure out this screen sharing thing with Skype, and we might get a little inception here before I get to the command line. Can you see my?
Oh,
there it is.
Yep.
Okay, so what I have here is a RHEL virtual machine that I've SSH'd into. You can see the command vagrant SSH. We have this, I mentioned this, Red Hat Development Suite, and it gives you, for developers, it's free, and it's fantastic. You get a copy of RHEL, you get vagrant VirtualBox that run the VM on your Windows machine. It has Docker built into it. It has Kubernetes built into it. And it has OpenShift built into it. So you get all this great stuff to do container development. And it's free for developers. You just go to our website and download it, and it's yours. And it's the supported, it's not just here, you're on your own. So that's, how you have the community versions of Visual Studio. This is kind of our community version of RHEL, so to speak. So I SSH'd into it. I have it running. This is running. I have a MacBook Pro that boots to Windows, and then I run a RHEL VM. So I always say I'm doing everything I can to break it. And so far, I've knock on wood, I haven't had any problems. So you mentioned with your Mac that you share between the Mac and the Windows. Well, I have here a shared folder, and there's the ones that are highlighted are directories. And then if I go into my Windows File Explorer, I just want to show people how one of the ways, something really cool here. Here's the same directory in Windows. Now, the reason this is a big deal to me is because if I want to edit my code that runs on RHEL, I can use Visual Studio because it's also in Microsoft Windows. So that's a big advantage for me. So I tend to use VS Code only because that runs like everywhere. I have a Fedora machine, and if I bring that up, I have a Mac. I have more Windows machines than I should probably admit to. But no matter what machine I use, if I run code, it comes up. And then I'll do this. I'll open PowerShell, and then if I'm in the folder, and here's another thing with PowerShell, right? So no matter what environment I'm in, if I do /shared, I get back. See how it's so that works in PowerShell or Bash. So my muscle memory, I've saved myself a little muscle memory there by doing that. So if I go in here and say .NET MSA, that's the code that I'll show you here in a second. Oops, messed that up. If I do code, if I could type, when I do this, and everything's popping up my other window. So you see, I can go right into my code from PowerShell, but it's the code is on my VM, so to speak. I think that's really cool.
Absolutely.
So here's a program that I run. I'm going to run this in a container. And it just gives you the name of the host. So if I go in here to... So I can't type and talk, guys. One of the things I'm showing here is there's a lot of things that you do in Visual Studio. You click this and deploy to Docker, and you pick this template to generate code. What I'm doing in RHEL is the command line. For example, I have to do Docker build. Well, let me just show you this first. I have this thing called pub that publishes the program. That creates, remember we talked about the standalone app? So that's this command line right here. So what it does is it builds it. I call it release. You can call it anything. And then it's saying the runtime ID, which if you look on the web, there's a list of these, is for RHEL 7.2 64-bit. So if I run pub, and it's just going to – the only reason I script it is it's less to type. You know, it's only one line, but I could do pub instead of typing .NET publish. So it's going to build this DLL and stick it the default location, which is fine. And then once that's done here presently – come on, guys. I have a lot going on. This is not a server. This is a laptop. And then I'm going to do a Docker build. And it, for those of you who aren't familiar with Docker, it's okay. You know what? Let me clear this. It's okay. You'll understand as I explain this real quickly. What I'm doing is I'm building on a base of RHEL 7. So that's my operating system that I'm using as my basis. But then I install some prerequisites. That's a fact of life. And then I just copy the code that I published into this directory in my image of Docker, if you will. That's what it's called. Then I set my working directory, and then it runs on port 5000. So it's real straightforward. Mm-hmm. Now, when you run it, it runs this command, which basically goes to the bash command line and says, run this right here, which is .NET MSA. So and all this does – so go ahead.
What's the reason why you put you set the working directory to that directory? Like, why not just put it to slash app? That's actually what I do in my files.
I don't know. This is a Docker file that started out with somebody else.
Okay.
In Red Hat, and it was given to me. And I have, you know what? I haven't really put that much thought into this part of it. It must have been their preference, and I just ran with it. Because what you're saying is it doesn't really matter. And in fact, most people just put it in app. It seems to be the de facto standard now.
Yeah, because there's no. It's simpler.
Yes, it's simpler.
And it's if there's no reason to do something different, then you might as well go with the simple option.
Yeah, and you know what? After you're done, this is on GitHub, so anybody we accept pull requests.
Yeah,
like, but I'm gonna change it after this because you just made a good point. It is like the de facto standard. I've been doing this demo for how many times? I just never even noticed.
I can give you one other Docker tip. If you put the working directory one line above where it is right now, then where it's in your add line, that second directory could be a dot.
A dot, right. Yeah, okay, so there you go, folks. That's what you just did is a perfect example of the open source community, and that most of the time that stuff happens like in a GitHub repo with discussions. But that's a perfect example of how the community part of open source, which I just think is great.
Right. If you send me the GitHub link to it, I'll make the change for you.
That would be awesome, because one of the best things, the most exciting things about having open source is getting your first pull request.
Yeah, I've had that one already. But
right.
Yes.
So, but one of the things I wanted to point out before I run it is that I did not install .NET in my Docker, you know, my image. So if I do a Docker run, and I can do this, everybody, which detaches it, but I'm not gonna. I'm gonna run it so it takes up my command line, because I just want you to see that. And then, I have to build it, don't I? Yes, Docker build. Oh God, .NET MSA. This is gonna build really quickly because as you can imagine, everything is cached locally and already on my system. So that's the build. If you're doing this from scratch, everyone, it takes a minute or two. It's not, doesn't take forever. So now I have an image called .NET MSA. Now, remember, there it is at the top of that list. This, all this is C# code. This is not, this is C#, .NET and Linux. This is, I just can't get over that. It just continues to blow me away. Docker run, and it runs on 5000, and I'll map it to 5000 just to keep life simple, and it's called .NET MSA. And I should come back, if you're new to this out there, you're running web services or websites at the command line now. So I have it listening on, I have to do this, the asterisk, because if I do localhost, it's running inside my VM, and that's the localhost, and I want to get to it from Chrome on my Windows host. There it is. I just happened to have it there. So there's the name of the first 12 bytes of the Docker container that's running it. So that's pretty cool that you can do that. There's another thing if I could show you with our OpenShift if you want me to, where we scale things up and down and do it uses Kubernetes and does like a rolling deployment or no zero downtime deployment. I don't know if we want to go into that now or not.
Well, I just have a quick question about, sure. So I think lots of people are familiar with the Docker public registry, you know, Docker
right.
Hub. When you do OpenShift, I believe that's the Red Hat container solution.
Yes.
Where do you get the base images? Do you get them from Docker Hub, or is there a specific Red Hat registry that you use?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, it depends on what you're building, right? Some images would come from the public, of course. I mean, you can do that. But so the Red Hat images, and let me see that. That was in my Docker file. If you see, we have this. This is our own repo for our images. And those you can only get to if you're a Red Hat subscriber. Now, if you get our free developer copy, you get that subscription, so you can get this. But anybody that's out there in the world that's not a Red Hat subscriber, meaning customer or developer that got this, they can't get this. In other words, they can't just go grab RHEL 7. So that is
Makes sense.
One of our what do you call that? You
know, benefits?
Yeah, benefit, but it's like, you know, the pay-to-play thing.
Yeah, so another question is, I'm just trying to help people
sure.
understand what the model is here. So on Docker Hub, there are these .NET images, so they
right.
they have Debian in them already, because obviously Debian is the public kind of standard for Docker.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the .NET Core runtime and SDK in them. If you don't want to do the standalone scenario that you just discussed, with the container registry, Docker registry that Red Hat maintains, are there .NET specific images, or do you always just build on plain vanilla RHEL?
You know, I be honest with you, I'm not sure. I think we have a Docker image, and the reason I'm not is early on. We did when we were before like release one, when we were all in preview
okay.
in those days. But that's when I realized that if I build with RHEL 7 and use a standalone, I get a smaller image. For example, mine's 287 megabytes. If I use the .yes, we do have a .NET image, I know for a fact now, because when I use that one, it balloons up to like 650 megabytes.
Well, that would be the SDK.
Right.
So there's a runtime image as well. So
right.
There's three scenarios.
Right, sure. We have all those, but the smallest footprint is this one. But yes, we do have what you mentioned.
Okay. Yeah, it's also probably worth noting that we are investing in this scenario we call trimming,
sure.
which is this idea that, like right now with standalone apps, sadly, you get more .NET Core than you need typically, just because of the way the tools works. And so we're making the tools more sophisticated,
right?
So that you only end up with the modules and binaries that you need. And so in the future, we'll be able to make those apps significantly smaller than what you see there today, which probably make you happy.
Yeah. So I don't. I did this once when I just typed at the command line, just for a thought experiment. I don't know if that's the entire right syntax, but for those that, if you've not played around with .NET on Linux, you can open your bash shell in Windows, and if you have Docker, you can just run, it's really kind of cool, you run this, and it puts you at a command line that has .NET ready. Like you could do .NET new and create a program.
Right, that's our SDK image, the one.
Right, that's really cool because it's basically a way to get into it without any kind of like investment or risk. You just like, I'm going to run this, and it's ephemeral. When you close it, it goes away, but it's your first, it can give you your first experience into .NET and Linux without having to basically do anything. Yeah, and that's really
cool. We have instructions on our Docker Hub page on how to do exactly that. So if people are listening, you can just go to our Docker Hub page and you'll be good to go.
So, that's the way to acquire .NET if you want to use Docker. What's the acquisition experience without Docker on Red Hat? Do you yum install .NET or?
So there's a URL called .NET, which is your site. Scott Hanselman refers to that as a vanity URL. I don't know if that's his term or if that's a global one. I love that. That's what my shirt is. Red Hat Loves .NET is a vanity URL. It takes you and it redirects you. And if you saw it, here you go. So he's like, okay, I'm going to download .NET Core. And then if you scroll down, you start seeing, oh, look at all this cool stuff. And here's Linux. And this is the step-by-step instructions. Now, the best way to go, you see all Ubuntu, Mint, Debian, Fedora, etc., OpenSUSE. And there's a link right here. This is the best way to do it because this will take you. There's instructions on that page right there, but there are some pieces that may be missing, may or may not. If you follow this link, you will make sure that you get every instruction. So here's our instructions. So, again, everything starts off with that .NET page. And from there, you can branch out to any operating system, including RHEL. See, we have server, workstation, and even Linux for scientific computing, which I have no idea what that is. And here are the instructions on how to do it. The black is obviously the command line. So you do it from the command line. It takes about 2 or 3 minutes with my home internet connection, which is, I pay for 75 megabits, so I get like 20. But it and then you have it installed. It's that easy. Okay?
Okay, very cool. So what do you think? Do we try the scaling demo?
Sure. Are you asking me?
We have time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, how about we introduce what that even is?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So first thing I'm going to do is go. So when you get our development kit, development suite, you get OpenShift, which is a wrapper around Kubernetes, which is a management tool that manages Docker. Let me explain. Kubernetes is written by Google, and it's a tool just to manage Docker containers. Running an application in Docker is one thing. Having an infrastructure or a platform to run it is an entirely different animal, so to speak. So the easiest way to do that is just to log into this and show you. So here's our dashboard. You don't need to use this, but it's nice to, especially for demos. On this side, I'll log in, and it comes with this OpenShift dev as a. Okay, oh boy, I mashed that.
What's OC stand for?
Oh, OpenShift
container.
Man line or CLI.
Oh, okay.
It's okay. Don't talk to me. I'm typing. Okay. I just can't. Can anybody do that? Type and talk at the same time? I'm going to create a new project. Now, so after I do this, my.NET, the first thing you'll see is, ignore this Ruby thing. That's just for an example because, again, you can do any language. But there's the project now. So now I have like what they call a project. And then I'm going to put up some containers into this. So if I click on this, you'll see there's nothing in it. There's nothing in it. So I can add here, but I'm not going to. I'm going to go to the command line. And in fact, I have create. Oops. I have a create green one. So you have this, you create a build like you would with my MS build, right? You have a build configuration. We have a build configuration for this tool, OpenShift, which is, again, it's all about Kubernetes. And then you run the build configuration. Then it builds an app. Now, you can either have it pulled down from GitHub, which is nice. Like, you can have it triggered. Like, if you do a pull request to GitHub, it'll automatically run. Mm-hmm. Or you can build it like I did here, which is a binary build, which is the same thing. It's a Docker image. But instead of putting the Docker image on my PC, it puts it inside the Docker Hub in OpenShift, and I'll show you that. So you can see, here's, for example, there's one, and then here's the one I just built 23 seconds ago. So this is saying that it's at this location. That's the project name. That's inside of OpenShift. I mean, it's physically on my machine, but if my OpenShift was running on Azure, let's say, it would be there. That's where it would be. Mm. So now I have this image, and if I go over here, it's running. I have a pod is the Kubernetes term, just to keep it simple, for a Docker application. Just an application. Just think of it that way. The problem is, see this create route? There's no route to it. There's no URL for it. Right? There's no way of getting to it. So then what I do here is I do an OC expose service, and it's called .NET Hello. And this is, you can create whatever URL you want, but if you do a default, it just uses what's called zip. And now it has a route. This is software-defined networking. So there it is, a container. Now, before, it was running in, if you remember, it had the first 12 bytes of the Docker image. Now it has the name of, has the pod. So there's one of them. Now, this is where it starts to get interesting, because if I go over here, here's another thing. That tilde slash, which is in Linux, is your home directory, works in PowerShell too. This is all great. It's really nice for muscle memory to not have to remember a bunch of stuff. Documents, PowerShell client. Now I have a watch my app. Now this is just kind of a curl command. It's hitting that application every second. Now if I come over here and scale that up, now how am I going to do this? Need screen real estate. If I scale that up to 2, if you watch in the background, first of all, 1,002, 1,003, 1,004, 1,005. In 5 seconds, I have another one running. You can see it there in the background how it's 2 of them. And so this is where the Kubernetes comes in. This is what's allowing me to do this. So now instead of just having an application running in Docker, I have an application running in a Docker, what do you want to call it? An infrastructure, an environment, a platform where I can start to scale. And this scaling you wouldn't do typically at the dashboard. You would have health monitoring and logging and performance logging you would do that, and you would have it automatically scaling based on your configuration. When I say you would do that, when you do get into Docker containers and then you start down this road toward what they call microservices and then distributed processing, that's a whole other world of development with its own set of challenges and things to learn. If you're a developer, it's great. You get to learn new stuff. You get to apply new stuff. If you're an architect, it's great because you have small programs that are easy to change and fix. And I got a really cool anecdote about that. But it's another world. There's more to it. The anecdote is Microsoft bought a company called Wunderlist, which is a to-do list. In fact, I think they just used it. They repackaged it, and it's now – I just read this week. It came out as something else. In any event, it uses a bunch of microservices. And the guy that founded it was talking about the microservices – and how they should be small and easy to change and easy to understand. And his example, this is really cool, how one night they had one of their microservices go down, and I think it was written in Erlang, and there was a person on call, and they didn't know Erlang. So they literally, in minutes, rewrote the application in their language and got it back up and running. That was
that's crazy.
It is crazy, but it's also great. That's the idea of the microservices. They're supposed to be so small. First of all, they should be small and easy enough to understand that even if you don't know the language, you should be able to figure, oh, I can figure out what it's doing. But this person just said, I'm just going to rewrite it. And they did it, and it worked. And he was like, that's – yeah, it is a very extreme example, but it does show you some of the things you could do. So I did a create green. Now, if I do a blue deployment – that should create another pod, another service out here called .NET Hello Dash Blue. And that will show up here. Typically, I change the text to say that, like, this is version 2. Oh, but
it appears on the web page, apparently.
Yeah, it should be popping up here. All right.
Nope.
Yeah.
No, there it is. Now, that downtime, that's okay for a couple of reasons. For three reasons. One, it's running on a notebook, so it's slow. But that's not valid. I mean, it shouldn't happen. Two, there's a thing called a readiness probe that you can set in Kubernetes that says don't even look at the other one until it's ready. Mm-hmm. I haven't set that. And the reason I have it is because I use this in my demo to feed into another point called the circuit breaker pattern, which is really cool. There's a thing called the Poly Project, thepolyproject.org. It's open source, and it's how I implemented the circuit breaker. The circuit breaker pattern basically says if a service is down, it by a certain amount of time that you define, you don't even attempt to hit the service. You mimic the call inside your code and then return a default value or some kind of flag back to who called you to let them to either let them know that this service is down or to not let them know by faking it. So, and that gives the one that's broken time to be healed. So the circuit breaker pattern, when you implement it here, you don't see that. You see a default value, like the container is named and it would just take the previous one. That's not the greatest example, but that is an example of how circuit breaker works. That's a really cool pattern, something to look up. So now I have these. Now, the one final thing I want to show is I got to get this window sized just right. Obviously, we all need bigger monitors all the time. And I have one called Switch. Let's see. It is switch. I'm running blue. So if I do switch to green, you see in the background, did you see how quick that was?
Yeah.
So, and then if I do switch to blue, oh, I broke it. Okay. So anyway, I broke it. That's where the service circuit breaker comes in. But the you did see it switch quickly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then
it did work for 2 seconds.
Yeah, well, what happened is my PowerShell script is not looking at the right URL. And which is my fault. That's a developer mistake. But that brings up one point I want to make is when you have to discover a service in networking in a distributed environment, that can be problematic. When you use something like Kubernetes or software-defined networking where you can assign a name, in this case, I have the mouse over it, then discovery becomes easy because you know that name and you can just go to that. Do you see what I'm saying? You're not looking around for an IP address and a port. Also, I have two applications here running at the same port and they're not colliding, and that's because of Kubernetes. You can see they both run on 5000, but Kubernetes is the one that says, well, I'm going to reroute it so that maybe it's actually using 6000, but it knows right to direct it there. So that's another thing you get from Kubernetes. So you get all this stuff, and it's all available now. And if you're a .NET developer, you can do this now. Like, you don't have to wait. You can do it now and be part of this whole movement toward microservices. Or if nothing else, you can start working in Linux, and you just expanded, increased your value.
That's so. Pretty cool. All right. Thanks for the demo, Don. That was nice. Are there any upcoming events that you'd like to talk about before we close the show? I know that there is a conference coming up, right?
Right. Let me drag this onto my screen because this is our big conference. It starts next Monday is the soft open, so to speak. Tuesday, May 2nd is the real opening. But our CEO will be there. Julia White, as Vice President with Azure and Security Marketing for Microsoft, she'll be speaking.
Oh, and Sam Ramji, I know this name.
Right. Kelsey Hightower, who is the guru of Kubernetes, he will be speaking. And then another thing I wanted to point out, we have a whole track called collaborative collaborative environment, collaborative community or something like that, collaborative culture. And it's just about building a culture in your company, in your community, where you work together. And Red Hat, I mean, that's our calling card, so to speak. So that plays all the way back to the original thing about Red Hat and open source and why it's important. And we're so glad that Microsoft's a part of it now. People don't realize Microsoft is, on GitHub, the largest contributor to open source software now. Mm-hmm. Kudos.
I've heard this.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was very interesting. Thanks, Don.
Thank you.
And I think that's all we had for today. Any announcements on our side?
Well, our big conference coming up is Build.
Yeah.
Our big conference is Build. That's in next month. Around, I think it starts on the 10th. And then, yeah, we'll be talking about .NET Core and containers and these similar kinds of things and where we're headed next with them. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yep.
I probably have some blog posts that I need to
write. It's always a big event, and it's the first time that it happens here in Seattle.
Yeah.
So that's going to be interesting.
Yeah. .NET Standard 2.0 is coming out soon, too.
Heard this, too.
Yeah.
I was just told that by a customer on Monday.
They seem to be well informed then.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah, we're all working very hard to make that happen.
So, yeah.
All right, very cool. Thank you again. Thanks for being on the show, and thanks everyone for tuning in today. And we will see you again, I believe, next week. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks for being on the show.